Welcome to Diverse Voices Book Review. I'm Hopeton Hay. My guests are Orville Vernon Burton and Armand Durfner, co-authors of Justice Deferred, Race in the Supreme Court. From the Cherokee Trail of Tears to Brown versus Board of Education to the dismantling of the Voting Rights Act, historian Orville Vernon Burton and civil rights lawyer Armand Durfner shine a powerful light on the court's race record, a legacy at times uplifting, but more often distressing and sometimes disgraceful. Addressing nearly 200 cases involving America's racial minorities, the authors probe the parties involved, the justices' reasoning, and the impact of individual rulings. Orville Vernon Burton is the prize-winning author of several books, including The Age of Lincoln. He is a professor of history at Clemson University and the University of Illinois. Armand Durfner has been a civil rights lawyer for over 50 years. He has been counsel for, among others, the NAACP Legal Defense Fund and the Mexican American Legal Defense and Educational Fund. Orville Vernon Burton and Armand Durfner, welcome to Diverse Voices Book Review.
Thank you.
Thanks. Good to be here.
So before we get started in talking about some of the Supreme Court decisions that I think have had a major impact on our lives, especially when it comes to race from the past to the present to the future, I do want to know how Vernon, you and Armand being the lawyer, you being the historian, how did you two first start working together and get to writing this book? And I'll start with you, Vernon.
Well, it's almost, as Yogi Berra would say, deja vu all over again, because it was a Supreme Court case. And the case was Mobile versus Bolden in 1980, which said that it didn't matter that laws discriminated. You had to show the intent of those laws. An issue that's come right back before the court, and we discussed throughout the book. But civil rights lawyers like Armand Durfner knew that it was a job of historians. It's what they do. They study motivation and purpose. So in 1980, I became involved in a court case that had gone on about 9 years. It had been decided, and then the judge recalled it after this, and decided favorably, and said you also had to show intent. So starting in 1980, we started arguing and discussing the issues that later become this book. And Armand was later on, maybe 10 years ago or so, was teaching in the law school. He was doing casebook and putting things together. He said, would you like to do a book together? And I jumped at the chance to be a part of what I think is a book that's so important to explaining how our democracy works.
And we've had some, the process of a lawyer's way of thinking and a historian's way of thinking, they work together real well. Once in a while, they clash, and those clashes are some of the things that I think have produced some of the great parts of the book. We bring the two-part perspectives together.
And I believe this, and I could be wrong, as I often am, Armand will tell you, that no historian could have written this book. That's why it was never written before. And I'm not sure, I don't believe any legal scholar or lawyer could have written it. It really is a combination of a historian and a legal scholar putting together from two disciplines.
But there's a third discipline. Our wives were vigilant as we went along to make sure that we were writing this book in the English language. And so one of the things I'm proudest of is the comments that we keep getting focus on how readable the book is.
And I think that's very important. I'm glad you did that, because my goal really is for people who are not lawyers, who are not historians, to have a general understanding of why the Supreme Court and race and what's happening with the decisions they're making are so important today. And I'm going to start off with the first case I recall learning about in school, the Dred Scott decision. And so, Armand, I'm going to start with you in terms of the meaning of the Dred Scott decision in the 1800s.
Dred Scott was an explanation or an expansion or an abuse, if whatever you like, of the old Constitution. It was the Constitution that, in fact, Dred Scott helped to kill. And Vernon can talk a lot about sort of the background of what the court did. It took a constitution that very much tolerated slavery. There's a debate about whether the Constitution accepted slavery or commanded slavery. At the very least, it tolerated it. But what the court did, majority slaveholders, they put not just slavery, but they put racism into the Constitution, as Vernon has said many times. And so they made the Constitution even worse than it had been. And that, among other things, helped hasten the Civil War, which we might have had to have anyway.
But I will say one thing is similar to today in some recent opinions. They did not have to decide this issue. If you look at the legal arguments, Armin can explain very clearly that Judge Taney wanted to go one step further than what the court was looking at and made it so that African-Americans would not be citizens and never had been. Of course, it's wrong too. North Carolina in 1830, free African-Americans voted on the same basis as whites. So they had been recognized as citizens. So it reminds me that we haven't learned a lot of our lessons from history, particularly the Supreme Court and some of their more recent decisions as well. But it did require then the 13th Amendment and finally the 14th Amendment and the 15th Amendment, which completely changed the Constitution. So instead of, as just Tony had hoped, that it would prevent a civil war, it helped precipitate it. It made people like an Abraham Lincoln have to take a real stand because they could tolerate slavery as a positive as a necessary evil. But now it was saying that slavery could be anywhere, including, as Lincoln said, in Illinois. And that was not something that could be tolerated. It drew the lines.
When Obama was elected president, there was some parties that sort of thought, okay, the age of race is over, that it no longer makes a difference. And it's almost seemed like historically, Vernon, that they sort of ignored that race has always been part of the history of this country from the Declaration of Independence to the Constitution throughout and so forth. So talk about why people need to understand that history has shown us that race has always been something that the government, whether it's through the Supreme Court or all the federal appointees to judgeships, that has had an impact on our country. And Vernon, if you could sort of give a quick historical perspective on that.
Yeah, it's a long one, and that's what our book sort of does, all nearly 400 pages. But I'm reminded right after the election, Stephen Colbert, when he still did the Colbert Report, said that rewriting history is a good thing. And now that a black man had been elected president, we can say that slavery never existed. And so we could do revisionist history. And though he was doing it in jest, I feel like many members of our Supreme Court, particularly our current Supreme Court, believe that. But what President Obama's election showed instead was just how significant race has been in U.S. history as part of the backlash against his election, I believe. Now, that's not part of the book, and we're moving from there. But one of the things that people have to remember is that the courts, you know, decide what is constitutional and what is not. But they're one of three branches of government, and it's so significant that the president is a winner-take-all election. We're not a parliamentarian form of government. And that president gets to appoint judges. And those judges, both federal and Supreme Court, are now appointed for life and have been. And so what a difference that makes over and over again. And that's one of the things we document in the book, I think, well, is what a difference timing makes and the judges that are appointed and why they are appointed and how they have influenced not just race relations for African Americans, but for, you know, 10 generations. If you look at American history, for 10 generations, the laws really supported not only slavery, but Jim Crow, white privilege, and discrimination. And now just for two generations have we even had moving away from that. So when we get discouraged, we have to think there have been 10 generations of court rulings that taught white people to be racist, or had to be. They had no choice.
And I want to have Armin jump in here, and specifically, one of the things you talk about is Brown versus the Board of Education, which is probably the best known Supreme Court decision among African Americans, period, right? Brown versus Topeka Board of Education, which comes out of Plessy versus Ferguson, separate but equal. I believe that was 1895 or 1896, somewhere about there. But I think in the book you talk about the changes in who was on the Supreme Court prior to that decision being made that actually tipped the scales in favor of the decision that they made. So, Armand, can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, it is curious. The justices in, not so much in Plessy versus Ferguson, but the justices during Reconstruction who did such a terrible job were almost all appointed by Abraham Lincoln and U.S. Grant as president. And in fact, one of the things that they did is to decide early on, very few people know about this case, a case called Katie Brown versus the Railroad. The Supreme Court had, the Railroad made a separate but equal defense. She was kept off the, kept out of the white cars and sued. And the Railroad said, but they're equal. And the Supreme Court unanimously in the early 1870s said that's bunk. Separate but equal doesn't count at all. It doesn't cut it. And yet in 1896, 20 some years later, the Supreme Court said, oh yeah, separate but equal is just fine. It paid no attention to their own precedent. And it helped bring our nation into a half century of Jim Crow that was almost worse in some ways than some of the parts of slavery. By the time we got to the Brown Court, these were different times, but they were different justices. Most of them had been appointed by President Roosevelt as part of the New Deal, and they brought about a new spirit. So, yes, it's the times, it's the justices, and I want to underline just what Vernon said about 12 generations, 10 or 12 generations, coming back to your point. What is stamped into our culture from generation to generation, from parents to children, from generation after generation, doesn't go away overnight. And we've only had two generations of trying to put it away, and that is not enough to get the job done.
Let me just put a footnote to Armin's thing, because we discovered what we believe is an unsung hero in Chief Justice Hughes, and before that, just Supreme Court Justice Hughes, who's best known for running against the supposedly progressive President Woodrow Wilson for the presidency. But what he did, and I love this as a historian, until Hughes, who sort of is, we think, leads up to Brown, before Hughes, the court would defer to Alabama or South Carolina, Mississippi, that they had made this decision. And then Hughes said, let's look at the evidence. Send the evidence and let's look at it. And looking at the evidence began to change, you know, not as much as we would like, but for the first time, overturning some of the most horrible of these cases. And I think that's significant leading up to Brown as well.
I want to go a little bit into history, Vernon, because one of the interesting things about that time is that Booker T. Washington made the Atlanta Compromise speech at the Atlanta Cotton Exposition. I believe that was in 1895. And to talk about strange bedfellows, W.E.B. Du Bois and Booker T. Washington are known as quote-unquote opponents, but W.E.B. Du Bois sent a telegram to Booker T. Washington congratulating him on the Atlanta Compromise speech. So talking about how people change over the years, the interesting thing about Booker T. Washington is while he presented himself as being okay with separate but equal, he was funding cases fighting segregation undercover. Talk about that, Vernon.
Yeah, his whole time, and if you think about Tuskegee, what's going on there and educating people, he's gotten a bad rap, I think, and historians are looking more carefully at what he was doing. You know, there's no doubt that he played a certain role, that whites could see him as an accommodationist, but he was really using his influence in all sorts of ways, of course. to support, particularly Black voting rights. I mean, he was very successful on the Peonage case, which again involved Justice Hughes. In getting those things done, he was able to manipulate in the North and get philanthropists to give money to support these cases. So he's a complicated person. In an earlier book, I said that he believed that the only color that mattered was green, that is money. And I don't think that's wrong, but he also believed in those. And he really thought, and it's not as bad as I think people think of it, that Black people could show with education and things that then whites would change. It's almost a Christian philosophy, if you think about it, that was sort of motivating him with a sort of hope that others would see this. One of the incidents, of course, to give you an idea that he was not as loved by white Southerners is when he went to have a meal with President Theodore Roosevelt, and then Pitchfork Ben Tillman, the segregation governor of South Carolina, says in speeches, we're going to kill 1,000 Black people.
He didn't say Black people.
Yeah, he didn't say Black people because of what Roosevelt has done by having a meal with a Black person. We forget what these laws said. In the South, it would have been against the law for Black and white. I mean, segregation was the law. He was working within those bounds and undermining it at the same time.
Armand, can you give our listeners sort of a general understanding that when we see these great Supreme Court decisions made, that there are a lot of other cases that sort of lead up to that particular Supreme Court decision? And we sort of touched on it a little bit with Brown versus Board of Education, but could you sort of, as an example, give sort of some of the other cases that led up to Brown versus Board of Education, the 1954 Supreme Court decision that desegregated the school system. And a follow-up question to that is the impact of saying in all deliberate speed.
yeah, the road to Brown is getting to be almost as well-known as Brown itself. What happened was it was a deliberate strategy that the NAACP, which is still a young organization, adopted. The first draft was planned by their staff lawyer in the late 1920s, a young man named Nathan Margold, who was a Jewish immigrant from Romania, had been a schoolmate at Harvard, a student of Felix Frankfurter, but a schoolmate of another young man who should be more famous than he is, which is Charles Hamilton Houston. Houston was a young Black man from Washington, D.C., and he became dean of Howard Law School in the 1930s and quickly got the law school accredited. Then he started working with the NAACP. Margold started with an outline that Houston modified and I'll say perfected, a litigation strategy. And it started by attacking the graduate and professional schools. These were areas where the Southern states had no education at all for African Americans. They had what I would call carfare education. If you wanted to go to law school and you were Black in a Southern state, they would say, you go get accepted at some out-of-state school and we'll pay your tuition and one train trip. And Fred Gray, the famous lawyer from Montgomery, went through that even in the late 40s, where he went to Western Reserve, now called, I think, Case Western Reserve, in Ohio, went to law school there. The NAACP, under the leadership of Houston and his disciple, his prize student, a young man named Thurgood Marshall, brought a lawsuit like that in Maryland in the mid-30s and actually won. We talk about that. Then they went to the Supreme Court with a case from Missouri, and the U.S. Supreme Court said carfare separate but equal is not in compliance with the 14th Amendment. And that was an opinion by Charles Evans Hughes, who Vernon has talked about. And from there, they went on chipping away and chipping away. And in 1950, finally, after a number of cases, we had the University of Texas case, where a young man named Heman Sweat sued University of Texas Law School, which didn't which had built this a law school for Texas, what at that time was called Texas Law School for Negroes. It's the now Texas Southern, or whatever it's called now in Houston, a major university. That school had a lot of facilities. In some ways, it was, if not close to equal, it was on the way. It had 65,000 volumes in the library. It had accredited, it had serious faculty. And yet the U.S. Supreme Court unanimously said it doesn't make the grade because it doesn't have the prestige. It doesn't have the contacts that lawyers get when they go to UT in Austin. And they said it doesn't cut it. And that was the next step 4 years later was Brown versus Board of Education.
So I'm going to have to jump in here because I want to make sure that we do sort of Vernon get sort of what's the big case in my mind today, and you can provide a historical perspective on the voting rights. So a key provision of the Voting Rights Act was declared unconstitutional under the John Roberts Supreme Court. And history, I think sometimes we forget, sometimes things work in our favor, sometimes they don't. I think maybe when things are going well for us, we forget that if you're not vigilant, that they could cycle back. So Vernon, could you sort of give a quick sort of historical overview of the importance of the Shelby versus Holder case in the context of the, once again, the challenge of voting rights? And I do want to add that in Texas, there's been new legislation passed to make it much more difficult to register to vote and to actually vote. Vernon?
Yeah, and I'm very familiar with it. And this will go down, I think, as one of the worst cases in the history of voting. It basically, it did not really touch Section 5, but it ended it. That is Section 4 of the 1965 Voting Rights Act, then amended and almost unanimously amended in 2006 by Congress, said that the formula didn't work. John Roberts used a quote that actually Armin wouldn't let me put in, but it sounded so much like the Dred Scott decision that things are not now as they were. But the basic problem is that he either mistakenly or perhaps intentionally, I don't know, but he misquoted the key precedent, which was from Chief Justice Warren in Catchin v. South Carolina, which after the 1965 Voting Rights Act, South Carolina, the first state to secede, also was the first state to challenge the Voting Rights Act, and most of the Southern or former Confederate states who were covered under the jurisdiction challenged the 1965 Act, and Warren said that it was justified by its history, by the remarks of people like Pitchfork Ben Tillman, the governor, and things that history had sort of caught up with the former Confederacy. But in that quote that he gives about the states and why you treat some states differently than other, Judge Roberts left out the key part, and it says the opposite in his decision, and that and how important it was. Minutes afterwards, I was the expert witness for the NAACP LDF on the voter ID law, and the minute that Shelby came down, they stepped back and put back in a voter ID law, which had been already declared by the federal courts in its effect, and they didn't have to touch intent, in its effect, discriminated against minority voters. It has really undermined the Voting Rights Act that was the preclearance from where the states had been the worst historically ever. And I cannot say enough about how disappointing this is as a court ruling. I think that's why it's so important, again, the vote and Congress to step up, and hopefully they will be able to get one of these voting rights bills back in to protect rights.
Armin, can you give the legal perspective, especially that concept that I became fascinated with, equal sovereignty?
It was invented out of whole cloth, so it's hard to give a legal perspective on it. That is as simple as
so
that.
So it has that happened before? Literally, I mean, misquoting a previous case, leaving key words out in an opinion. So Chief Justice John Roberts, pulling from that 1966 South Carolina case, selectively pulling words out of that quotation in his opinion.
Well, let me give you a modern day, what I think is equivalent and not quite the same way of pulling words out. And that's the abortion case, the new abortion case, which the Supreme Court refused to stop. Texas's law, if it wasn't so serious, would be regarded as a joke. Because if abortion is a constitutional right, if reproductive rights have constitutional protection, as they do, at least for the moment still, then a state cannot legislate against it, cannot participate against it. And participating means not just prosecuting, but letting cases go to the courts. So the courts can no more entertain a case against under this statute than the governor can. And the notion that a law is designed to just let people sue on it, it's just insane. And the U.S. Supreme Court has many precedents in which previous courts have stopped states from using tricks to get around established precedent. Many cases like that, including cases where people try to use, private lawsuits to get around the rule that a state can't participate. And the Supreme Court has repeatedly thrown those out. And here, they just threw up their hands and said, I guess Texas can get by with it for the time being. Just an outrage.
I'll add, too, though, that it's not just Shelby County has not got the attention, but there were two main enforcement parts of the Voting Rights Act. There's the 19 that we just talked about, Section 5 coverage, which, as I said, literally, if you went back and looked at Texas or almost any other state under Section 5, what a difference it made. These horrible things at least did not get approved. But the minute it changed, it did. Now we've just had the Brnovich case, Arizona, where Judge Alito has gone after Section 2, which was the right for people to bring and make an argument. It was very hard to prove intent, but at least there was a way with Arlington Heights laid out, the 1977 insurance case, how you can prove intent or show at least that race was involved. And I believe that he has misread this very much, and again, use the same phrase that Judge Robert did basically when he talks about the renewal of the Voting Rights Act in 1982 and says that today is not, or 1982 is not like today, which also echoes back to the Dred Scott case.
I'll bring that back to your actual question. In the Brnovich case on the purpose section of the opinion, Justice Alito says specifically, the cat's paw theory, which is a way of proving cases, does not apply to legislative bodies. That is absolutely not true. It's just false because it ignores a fundamental part of Supreme Court jurisprudence, which is, as Vernon mentioned, the Arlington Heights case. So here's Alito for six members of the court deciding a case by inventing doctrine and taking doctrine that the Supreme Court had itself adopted and ignoring that, not even mentioning. They don't even talk about the precedent that they're throwing to the wayside. Just absolutely untrue.
And for precedents, there's a lot of it described in the book. One of my favorite ones is looking, as Armin traced it out legally, how the word aforesaid can change an incredible precedent that goes toward a bad ruling on race.
I want to shift gears here because I want to make sure that we cover something you said in the conclusion of the book, that the justices of the U.S. Supreme Court today are reading civil rights protection cases with recent state laws, reading civil rights protections and constitutional amendments and civil rights laws for as little as they can mean. And sometimes it's implied that they're doing this because they're conservative. But you, as you demonstrate in your book, the conservative justices will read other constitutional amendments, other laws, and for as much as they can mean. And I think we had talked a little bit earlier about the law that allows basically unlimited political contributions. And so talk a little bit about this. I mean, frankly, the Supreme Court just shifts back and forth because they do overall, the Supreme Court appointees by presidents, presidents have political agendas. And they appoint justices who they think will move forward whatever their particular political agenda is. And I'm going to go ahead and start with Armin on that. And then if Vernon, if you could follow up on that, Armin.
Well, yeah, our point about that you very clearly brought out the notion about reading civil rights laws as narrowly as they can. The basic theme of the book is that judges have choices. And when citizens read Supreme Court opinions or read about them, they have to remember that judges have choices, that judges are very political people. And this bunch of majority judges happens to make a bunch of choices in which they exalt certain rights, the rights of corporations, get rid of other rights, which are the rights that we fought a horrible civil war for. The 13th, 14th Amendment came at a cost of 700,000 lives, and they meant a lot. And any originalist who was an honest originalist would pay attention to that, and that's what we don't have today.
Yeah, I think Armin has pretty much said it all, but I have some hope. It depends on which day, of course, that I have the hope. But we have seen justices who surprise people, less so now because they study more and scrutinize the records and and almost all of them come from certain law schools and have been judges, a lot different than, say, Earl Warren and the Eisenhower appointment, who almost didn't happen as well. But it makes such a difference who gets to appoint those justices. Jimmy Carter got none. Richard Nixon got to really change the court. Reagan got to change the court. And one of the, just to show this example of why the vote matters, the 1980 Reagan Revolution, Ted Kennedy had been the Senate Judiciary Chair Committee. And Strom Thurmond was on that committee from South Carolina, who'd been the Dixiecrat candidate. When Thurgood Marshall came up for the Supreme Court and for another court, Thurmond just gave him a heck of a time, grilling him, you're a comment, all these kind of things that just were hurtful. And then William Brennan, these two old warriors near the end, in fact, Brennan comes up to Thurgood Marshall and says to him, is it true that now that Strom Thurmond is going to be chair of the Judiciary Committee? And, you know, Brennan was a slight, small man, and Thurgood Marshall was a giant of a man, both intellectually and physically. And he puts his arm around, they're two in their robes, and these two old warriors walk off to their chambers together for their last battles. I think that's rather symbolic to me of how critical these elections are. If Thurgood Marshall had, he lived on, but he was sick. But if he had not resigned, he didn't have to. It would have been Bill Clinton who would have had the appointment that replaced Thurgood Marshall, who was then Clarence Thomas by the first President Bush. And that is the court then that decides the election between Gore and the second Bush. Think about how those differences could have played out in terms of the importance of who's on the court and how they decide cases. All the randomness of history and timing of appointments and why it matters who you vote for president.
And that 2000, I'll just follow up on one point, which you made earlier, Hopkins, about the 2000 election. You had five justices, including the fifth justice appointed by George H.W. Bush instead of Bill Clinton to succeed Thurgood Marshall. Those five justices came up with an absolutely flabbergasting decision under the Equal Protection Clause. Five justices who had virtually never paid any attention to the Equal Protection Clause when it was raised by minority plaintiffs, but in that election and in cases brought by white people, then that's where the Equal Protection Clause made some was important to them.
I want to talk a little bit about, there was a term you guys brought up earlier that today you have to show intent of discrimination. And to me, from just a non-lawyer type, if you're discriminating, you're hiding your intent to discriminate. You don't want people to think you are actually discriminating. So how did the court get to the point where they said you have to prove that someone is actually showing intent to discriminate, as opposed to we're looking at the results and 85% of the whites are approved for the loan versus 5% of blacks? I just made those numbers up, by the way, but as sort of an example.
They're not far off, I believe, if we go back and look at the notes of where they were. But it goes back. It's not just in voting, as you said, which is the example that I gave. And in that case, Congress stepped up and renewed the Voting Rights Act and said that it did not matter. You didn't have to show intent. But then with further cases, now let Armand elaborate on them, particularly latter cases trying to say that you had to show intent. Intent is hard to prove. When the case that I got involved in, it was not as difficult, because back, I remember Witz in the paper saying, oh, what are we going to do about Mobile versus Alabama? We're going to dig up the Mobile council people and say, out of their graves, and say, did you intend from 1911 to discriminate? And, you know, but that's what historians do. But people back then were very clear. I mean, they were sort of proud of their racism and why they were doing these things. They said it. You could see it in the newspapers. You could see it in private. Of course, today, as you say, it's very hard to prove it. There were ways through Arlington Heights, the 1977 case. But if Judge Alito's is right, and I don't think he is, it's going to be even harder, and it already was, of how you go about through a totality of circumstances, as it's called, or using the Arlington Heights factor to show that race was involved. It doesn't have to be the whole motivating factor. And Armand, you should elaborate on the legal side of this case, because it's really damaging. It is nearly impossible. It already was very hard, but now it's almost impossible.
I will add to that. We think the question of race, Hope, is really important, and we've spent a whole chapter on the issue of purpose versus effect, because it is, this, in many ways, the central issue of today's Supreme Court. And as Vernon says, as soon as the Supreme Court said you had to prove intent back in 1976, they followed that up in 1977 with this Arlington Heights case that at least showed you how to do it and sort of laid out the blueprint for how you could do it, and it made it possible, not easy, but possible. Now the Supreme Court, three times in the last 3 years, has dumped it, and two opinions by Justice Alito, and one of them coming from the Texas reapportionment a couple of years ago, in which lower courts said, well, we are using Arlington Heights, and we believe intent has been shown, and in each case, the Supreme Court reversed those decisions. In two of the cases, didn't even mention Arlington Heights, and the third case distorted Arlington Heights and used half of Arlington Heights and left out the other half. So the Supreme Court has taken the lifeline that an earlier court, the Berger Court, gave in the 70s, and is saying basically, well, you can't prove intent, but you have to. And they're doing it without telling. They're doing it dishonestly without saying what they're doing.
And I'll say again how politics plays in. I was involved in that reapportionment case as an expert witness for Gary Bledsoe. And when I first did my report and deposed, the Justice Department was on the same side I was. When it comes back in 2017, I'm deposed again and revised. The Justice Department is on the other side. I mean, it matters who you vote for.
And let me just add, Gary Bledsoe, I think we mentioned him earlier, is the president of the Texas NAACP. I want to do a shift to programs that set goals for minority business participation on contracts and some of the Supreme Court decisions that have affected that. The one that I remember the most is Croson versus Richmond, 1989 Supreme Court decision. And that decision basically, as my lawyer friends kept telling me, and Victor Good, who's a works for the general counsel for the National Office of NAACP, they kept talking about this term narrowly tailored. We hear these terms that you have to prove that there's been discrimination against these firms in accessing these contracting opportunities, even if the city is 30% Black, but only 0.5% of the contracts are going to Black firms. And then you have to do what are called these disparity studies, where you have to go out and prove that there are firms that are ready, willing, and able to do this particular work. And for me, I look at it sometimes and say, if you never had the opportunity to participate in this marketplace without discrimination, how are you gonna have a good, ready, willing, able population of businesses when you were actually kept from being able to access those opportunities on top of the discrimination when it came to lending? And a historical, you know, if you look at the wealth of the Black community, you can't look at where we are today, or in this case, 1989, without looking at how we have the lack of resources and opportunities because of all the barriers that kept us from being able to fully develop. So that's a statement, not a question, but I'll start with you, Armand, and then we'll go to Vernon.
It's a long story, and there is a little bit of affirmative action still going on. Not widely publicized and not big programs. And some of it is in universities, but now there's talk that the Supreme Court may be getting ready to get rid of it all. Let me just say this about affirmative action. It's not a happy topic. We all wish we didn't need affirmative action, but you don't take 10 generations or 12 generations in which you widen the gap and then say, never mind, we're starting fresh, and expect, as President Johnson, Lyndon Johnson said, you can't do that and expect to even fair. But at the same time, if people were vigorous in enforcing civil rights in other ways, it might be possible to say, well, maybe other ways can succeed, and maybe we don't need affirmative action. But we have a court now that is blocking every other way of making racial progress. And yet at the same time, they come up with, they put an end, or almost an end, to affirmative action. And they talk about the importance of equal treatment, but they're not talking about it in other cases.
Let me just add, though, that one of the things Arm and I do in discussing affirmative action is talk about an affirmative action where nobody was upset, although African-Americans should have been. We had an affirmative action program in America, but it was for whites only. And we won't go through all the details. You think of something that's sort of neutral sounding, like the voting rights laws that discriminate, the GI Bill. But the GI Bill really discriminated against African-Americans and some other minorities in very subtle ways. For instance, an African-American is a veteran and he wants to go to college. He can only go in the American South, former Confederacy, and many other states to a historically Black college. And I love historically Black colleges. I'm not trying to put them down in any way. They have done tremendous, but they didn't have the resources and the networks that others did. The veterans can use the veterans benefit to buy a home, which they did. But because of state and federal enforced redlining covenants, they could not buy in areas where their home increased in value. And then you use that money, as my father-in-law did, to send my wife to college. And at the same time, then the African-American veteran's home is not evaluated because they are blocked from where they can go. Even, you know, the Social Security, the Congress's Southern bloc made sure that domestic workers and farm workers weren't covered or by the minimum wage. And so what do you have where the majority, where the great number of people who are working in those are African-American or minorities, then they aren't even covered under those. And it goes on and on and on. So affirmative action really matters. And one of the things that bothers me the most about the Closen decision is that Sandra Day O'Connor made a statement, which I don't want to say too much about, but basically that maybe, looking at the evidence, that maybe blacks weren't interested in construction. That's why there were so few construction firms. But she makes just the opposite argument for gender and women. And it's almost exactly the same, but different. It shows how one's personal background makes a difference in these decisions. And secondly, they literally, in the Croson case, they just ignore in many ways the Fuller Love decision, which was a decent decision that everyone seemed to accept, with a few who were quoting Justice Harlan about, you know, the Constitution be colorblind, and a missed, again, I think, reading of what he was saying. At any rate, enough.
Let me just add to this on that. Before the modern day, when there's arguments about affirmative action that favors, or that could favor, minority people, we had, as Vernon points out, 40 years of the most gigantic affirmative action program in the history of the world. It put 35 million families in their own homes, many in suburbs, mostly all white, and it was a white affirmative action program. And it created a middle-class white America. There are pockets of white poverty in America today. There certainly are. But by and large, white people in America are in the middle class. And that was done with government assistance, government money, government rules over a period of 40 years in the New Deal, World War II, post-war period. And suddenly, when one group now has become so far ahead, we have a Supreme Court that's saying, okay, stop, no more. We're not going to equalize.
And at the same time, they were writing into the FHA had underwriting guidelines that were discriminatory. We had to have the Community Reinvestment Act passed in 1977 to make credit available to the entire communities.
Who do you think invented redlining? It's the government.
Exactly. And of course, and let's talk a little bit about the importance of the activist organization. So Chicago sort of led the way in pushing through the Community Reinvestment Act in terms of the redlining issue. And also talking about the NAACP, which was started to push through an anti-lynching law. 1907, 1908, W.E.B. Du Bois is probably the most famous of the people that were there originally, but it was also a multiracial organization. It also included Black women, Ida B. Wells, and, you know, Jewish people and white people coming together. And the first move was to fight, to push through an anti-lynching law. Talk about the importance of these activist organizations in protecting the rights and lobbying and fighting against, you know, representing these communities when it comes to the Supreme Court. I'll start with you, Vernon, and then we'll close out with Armin.
Okay. Well, it was very significant, of course, and it follows a riot and lynching in Springfield, Lincoln's hometown, sort of significant. And I just want to add that there were, in fact, white Southerners, some had been former Confederates, who had adopted the spirit and the meaning of 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment, who also were members of this emergent NAACP to fight for Black rights and minority rights. So it really was an interracial coalition. And it continued in terms, even under Thurgood Marshall, of whites working with the NAACP and some Southern whites. So it's very easy to sort of stereotype and not look at the differences. But the NAACP in particular, with the anti-lynching, you know, they would have a flag that flew outside the NAACP building in New York that would say how many lynchings occurred that day and things like that, to bring attention that led to this. It's ironic that we never got that anti-lynching law passed, but I'm also remember both Martin Luther King Jr., Ben Mays, and many others who said, give us the right to vote and we'll take care of things like lynching, that it all goes back in a lot of ways to the centrality of voting. And we often forget the NAACP was pushing for voting rights, because we think of Brown v. Board, and what I think of is the Clarendon, South Carolina case, which is the Deep South case and the one that Thurgood Marshall argued for Brown, but they had been working really on voting that had been so central all along. Later on, you have MALDEF, which is sort of in LULAC and other organizations which come for others. So the Native American group, but they were all sort of modeled on the NAACP. And Armin's already talked about Charles Hamilton Houston and Thurgood Marshall and what they did. But it's just amazing with the NAACP. Thurgood Marshall won case after case. I mean, he came close to being lynched, even in the Groveland case, but other times risking his life over and over again. And this man, this brilliant attorney, hardly lost a case at the Supreme Court against almost overwhelming odds. Then he gets on the court and he's on the losing side of opinions most of the rest of his career.
Let me add real quick, MALDEF, the Mexican American Legal Defense Fund, LULAC, the League of United Latin American Citizens, a civil rights organization for the Hispanic community. Armin?
Yes, a lot of those organizations, both citizens organizations and legal organizations, played key roles. And we've talked about a number of them in the book. And one interesting place was in a case called Shelley versus Kramer, involving racially restrictive covenants. There were amicus briefs from almost any kind of group you could imagine, from American Indians to Japanese Americans to every single group, Jewish groups, etc.
Orville Vernon Burton and Armand Derfner, co-authors of Justice Deferred, Race, and the Supreme Court, thank you so very, very much for the important work you've done with this giant of a book. Thank you for being guests on Diverse Voices Book Review.
It's a real honor and so good to talk with you and see your insights.
Thank you for listening to this podcast edition of Diverse Voices Book Review. I'm Hopeton Hay, host and producer. The theme music is provided by Wright Productions. You can follow the show on social media. Under Facebook and Instagram, it's Diverse Voices Book Review, or Twitter under @DiverseBooksHay. And be sure to rate the podcast 5 stars.